I'm going to go ahead and readjourn the special meeting of the Planning Commission regarding zoning. We are on part three of the presentation. So the floor is yours. Yes.
I just wanted to discuss some logistics. So, you know, understanding we'll be here for the afternoon. As I understand, I know the consultants have some other things where they're going to have to leave by 5 p.m.-ish today.
By 5.
Yeah. So, questions to think about, and I guess you don't have to answer this right now, but as we're going through, you know, these next two sections are really kind of the meat and potatoes of the zoning code, as you know. They're very important. So, you know, maybe we can go through this next part four, see where we're at and decide, you know, do we want to carry this over to, you know, just our another next standard Planning Commission meeting, which is in 2 weeks, or do a special meeting for that portion. So just something to think about kind of as we go through this next section, if that's okay.
Yeah. And what time does staff need to leave?
We are here at your leisure.
Okay. Because I was...
So we'll be here, we'll adjourn around 11:23 tonight.
So I will say we'll make sure we get you out of here early.
Yeah.
Would be my goal. You know, let's see where we're at 4 o'clock.
Yeah, and then
at the latest.
Okay.
You know, that'll give us another 2.5 hours to get through stuff. But I agree, especially because there's going to be changes. We're going to see you guys again. Mm-hmm. I will make a note of
set
a timer, but good call.
Okay.
So, okay. Thank you.
Wonderful. Okay. Well, thank you for all of the robust conversation on part three, which was focused on standards, general development standards. Now we are moving into the part of your zoning code, which is establishing standards for specific land use types. And the purpose really here is to find consistency and adopt the goals and policies in your general plan. And then really ideally is to minimize potential land use conflicts. So that's kind of the lens that we use here to how we are applying these standards into the thresholds. And one of the questions that we are asking you is, did we get these thresholds right? Are the standards that we are applying, do these make sense from what you're hearing from your constituents? They make sense with what your vision is. And so in here, what you'll find are permit thresholds for certain types of land uses, and then both operational and performance standards for land uses. And here are kind of these land uses that we're talking about. There's standards in here for accessory buildings and structures. So how do we handle land uses and activities that are accessory or subordinate to primary land uses? A perfect example of that would be like a home occupation or something that is subordinate to a actual home or another primary land use. We have standards for accessory dwelling units, home occupations, vacation rentals, wireless telecommunication facilities, or going to be your cell towers, density bonus law, which I'll get into. Then in here is where we also house your agricultural right to farm standards, as well as your SMARA or your surface mining and reclamation standards. So let's dive into some of the higher level changes made here. One of the newer items and sections that you'll find in this part is a new use, which we're calling a caretaker's unit. And it may be an already established use that you're familiar with that already exists in the county, but now we're actually calling it out and we're creating some guidance and some standards for it. And think of caretaker's units as a residence or a single unit that would be accessory to a primary land use that would allow for the living quarters of a caretaker. So think of a cemetery, think of an industrial complex that had a guards unit, someone that needed to be on site 24 hours. It's a unit dedicated to them. It's not a residential property. This is just a minor residential unit attached to a larger commercial or industrial facility. So we've clarified that you have one per parcel. We've set a permit threshold of 1,000 square feet maximum, just to provide some guidance. And then establish this as really as an allowed accessory land use to provide some flexibility for our commercial land uses. Another new land use and section that you'll find in part four has to do with emergency shelters. This is a state mandated land use. So the state requires that emergency shelters be allowed in at least one zoning district within your jurisdiction. The intent of these emergency shelters is multifold. It is to serve as emergency sheltering in case of events, emergency events. They are also, these are also included as shelters for those experiencing homelessness. So kind of multi-purpose, multi-phase emergency shelters. So in compliance with state law, we set some operational standards that we felt were best practice that provided at least some operational guidance, but did not go into, did not raise, I would say, the standards into really heavy-handed procedures. State law doesn't necessarily require that that we set standards and operational requirements for emergency shelters, but we felt that if we are going to be introducing this as an allowed land use by right, we should at least provide some guidance. So one of our questions that we're also asking you tonight is, in these new standards for emergency shelters, what other provisions or guidance would you like to see based on some concerns you may have for compatibility, meaning that we have to allow this land use by right in at least one zoning district? What we have proposed for these regulations for your consideration include a maximum number of beds, so we can put a cap, a requirement for on-site management, a requirement for security during normal business hours, a distance requirement, so that we don't have emergency shelters that are located and we have an overabundance in a certain area, and then also a limit on the length of stay. These are intended to be temporary shelters for temporary use, not longer-term living facilities. So we've provided some, at least some minimum standards for consideration.
Before we move on,
yes,
I'm on that section also, and I had a question there. In Siskiyou County, and I may be incorrect here, but it's my understanding that by default, school gymnasiums and or multi-purpose rooms serve as emergency shelters in rural communities outside incorporated areas. And so I guess my question is, that's not, schools are not necessarily industrial in those zones, but I don't think we have in Siskiyou County a single structure that was built and is designated as an emergency shelter. And under the current economic climate, who's going to build one? We've always used schools and, in some instances, churches and fairgrounds have been the emergency shelter. Is it possible to have a building, once it's built, to also be classified as an emergency shelter despite the zoning that it's located in?
Yeah, I think for practical purposes in an emergency, yes. There's been a lot of changes at the state level regarding like emergency shelters. We're just basically, and the consultants can probably speak more to this, we're required to speak about it in certain zoning areas. It's a state law. And so I think that's what we were trying to integrate was this new state law. And it's through like the housing element law stuff where, and I don't remember the specifics, but where there could potentially be a home in a certain zoning district, I think we also have to allow for emergency shelters to be constructed in those similar zones. So it's more of a state law, not necessarily like practice that's been done in the past. Or locations that have, you know, previously served as an emergency shelter.
And the primary distinction would be those what you're referencing, yes, is more of what's happening kind of in real time. The use of those facilities, though, would be accessory to the primary land use, which would be a school. And in this case, the state has this requirement that the primary land use could just be an emergency shelter. Now, in practical aspects, in Siskiyou County might not actually ever be developed. At a minimum, we still have to show that allowance,
okay,
with the understanding that we have the fairgrounds, we have school gymnasiums, we have these other, which make much more sense, much more practical aspects. We just, for at least just this checkbox, if you will, just have to also say, and if you proposed it as a single land use, we'd also allow it.
And allowed by right, not through use.
Correct.
Right.
As long as it met the standards mm-hmm. that we've established. So that's kind of why we are proposing, in this case, the development of some standards. Otherwise, it would be essentially a free-for-all in this case. So as long as the emergency shelters are complying with these objective standards, they are allowed by right. If they do not comply with these, then they're either not allowed or they would have to go before the Planning Commission.
So I guess to finish that thought, on Section D, permitted use, it flat out says all other zoning districts' emergency shelters are prohibited. I guess I'm thinking of Downriver, Happy Camp, Syad. There is no commercial zoning district. Well, a little bit. But you're not going to build an emergency shelter on the old mill site. But you're basically residential or ag or timber. Would it not make sense that may be allowed by use permit?
We do allow it, or according to the
rather than simply say prohibited, because when I see prohibited, then that tells me that if somebody comes into planning and says, hey, for the town of Happy Camp or Syed Valley, we have this little 1 acre parcel, it's rural residential, we'd like to build, you know, a four-walled structure that's fire safe, et cetera, for an emergency shelter if needed. But because it's on residential, if staff goes in here and sees prohibited in all other zoning districts, are we going to have a staff sometime in the future that isn't as understanding as we currently have? Is it, flat out prohibited instead? Well, hey, we can do a special use permit and go before the Planning Commission to see if they authorize it. That would make sense to me.
Right now, we have it as you can have an emergency shelter in mixed residential, which is like apartment buildings, more densely
populated. Downriver
is what we have. And then we don't permit it in rural residential and the low residential areas, just because I don't think you would want a giant emergency shelter, say in like Scott Valley, where it's usually rural residential or ag. It doesn't make sense. But in a mixed residential area where there's already a lot of services, that sort of thing, that would make sense. And we also allow it in industrial with the use permit. So permitted by right and commercial is
so basically if somebody wanted to do that for the community of Syed or Happy Camp, they'd first have to come in and request a zone change to get it zoned commercial or industrial in order to be allowed to build an emergency shelter
or residential mixed. And I think you want it that way, otherwise you might end up with, like I said, emergency shelter in an area where you wouldn't necessarily work, or there might be more of a resistance from that community. We wanted to allow rural residential to stay as much as possible rural residential.
I'm just thinking for some of our
rural
areas that are going to be facing catastrophic wildfire threats for the next decades. If their ingress egress is not there, if they had a fire safe emergency shelter that the community could go to, it would get used.
Yeah, and like Downriver, there's not too much availability of other zones that are not RR or like AG2 or like the main two.
You have the old mill site, and that's basically it.
There's like some commercial highway, and that's about it.
It says established. Are they talking about already existing, or is this a new construction?
New things are coming in. Like if you want to establish a new emergency shelter. But again, for emergency shelters, you always want them close to services, right? You don't want them in rural residential, or they might be isolated. It makes no sense to house 1,000 people out, away from closer to services, closer to, like Warika or whatever, you know, just closer to the town. So you want them in a more densely populated area.
Okay.
Go ahead. Mm-hmm.
Other important aspect of this code, and certainly in our rural counties that we work in, is the flexibility in home-based businesses. That provides a lot of support for a lot of your unincorporated homeowners and residents. So there are two uses that you'll find that allow home-based businesses and home-based occupations to take place.
Is that following the cottage industry, which we had 2 years ago? That was introduced, right?
Mm-hmm.
Okay, so that one and the same or different?
For what again?
So our we did the ordinance for the cottage industry for jams, jellies, etc. As long as they're using a commercial kitchen, blah, blah, blah. Is that the same as this?
No, this is different.
Different.
This is
so that's just specific to like the food preparation piece.
Okay.
So you could have both in a facility or, you know.
All right.
Correct. So this is, yes, it's not having to do with food specifically, but it could include food, in which case you would also have to comply with the cottage food industry permit requirements.
Okay.
But essentially the way that works is we have two different land uses that we acknowledge.
Mm-hmm.
One is what we call a home occupation. The step above that is called a home enterprise. The idea here is that these two land uses, though, are still accessory to a residential land use. So the idea is that you have a piece of land, it's a house, the primary land use is a residence, and these are activities that can take place on that property that are still accessory to that. And the reason we set that threshold is because as soon as it becomes not accessory, and it becomes the primary land use, in which case we'll look at the other permits that would be required, and we would look at it no longer being considered residential. So we have a home occupation and a home enterprise. Home occupations I like to think of as our home offices. You have really no, from the outside perspective, there is no real intensification or change to your home. No one would know that you're taking place or you're having a business. In this, we have some thresholds where you are allowed to have lower intensity business activities, a home-based office. You have a limit on how much of the percentage of your residence can be dedicated to that business. We set a threshold of 25% of your dwelling area. And then employees would have to be residents of the home. Because the idea is that this is kind of your home-based business. So the residents of that business would have to be also, the residents of the home would have to be employed in the business.
Would daycare fit under this?
So daycare is a separate regulated land use according to the state of California, which has its own set it has its own complicated set of requirements.
So a daycare facility would not have to also meet these requirements as a home occupation.
A home daycare.
Correct.
Correct.
Correct. Okay. I want to make sure that we're not trying to.
Mm-hmm. The state has its own legislation.
Right.
On
I was just making sure
operation.
Adding this in that we weren't going to have a. Okay.
Great. Yep. Separate. Great questions and great clarification. And then to facilitate actual customers, there actually is a customer allowance. So you're allowed to have at least up to one customer at a time. If you want to kind of go beyond that, or let's say your home occupation becomes successful enough that now you need to have more customers and you're saying, hey, we actually need to hire some more staff to facilitate this and we need to actually expand out of our 25% of our home, then you are bumped up in what we're calling a home enterprise. Still accessory, still subordinate to your residential land use, but allows you more flexibility. So now you have a little bit more allowance. So moderate commercial activities, moderate business activities intensity. You can now use up to 50% of your dwelling for this type of activity. You can have up to 3 employees, one of which has to be a resident. And then you can have up to 3 customers at a time. In order to get this, you would have to apply for an administrative use permit, which is applied for and determined and approved by the director. So this would not have to go to the Planning Commission. And at least provide some guide rails and flexibility as to the operational requirements for these types of businesses. And the idea is to eliminate the best way possible nuisances or conflicts. You got your rural residential property, you were anticipating it being a rural residential property, not also having a business operating out of it on a daily basis. And so we want to acknowledge that, property owner rights, and create some at least some guidelines for the types of businesses to take place should you choose to endeavor on a home occupation or home enterprise. Next set of land use regulations that you'll find here are new temporary use regulations. And these aren't state mandated. This is really just a best practice that we are recommending for incorporation into your zoning regulations to set some parameters around temporary activities, whether those be community farmers markets or festivals or concerts. But the idea is to create some standard guidelines that would set a term limitation on these types of activities that would and create some enforcement mechanisms for you to hold these standards that you would apply to users. In these temporary use regulations, there are the permit thresholds. So depending on the intensity and the impact of activities determines the type of permit that you would be requested to apply for. So lower impact or smaller activities would be that zoning clearance permit. Most temporary uses, however, would fall in that administrative use permit level in which the planning director is reviewing and approving these things. And then larger scale events that are exceeding those permit thresholds would go to the Planning Commission for their review. At a minimum, we have set some operational limits to these types of events that include frequency standards, some attendance standards, and then we also have codified and brought in some standards clarifying temporary residences and temporary other types of uses beyond these temporary special events that the board can enact during emergency situations. So kind of have covered the gamut of what we feel temporary uses may include. Commercial activities, emergency scenarios, and then also temporary residences. And then within this section, we also have removal and site restoration standards in which all structures or items that were erected at a temporary event would have to be removed. So at least we have some language there for some enforcement mechanism. A new land use that you will also find in this section and in the in part five, which will follow this discussion, is what we're calling a special event facility. And this would be a dedicated land use that would be dedicated and reserved for special events. Think of a wedding venue. And in here, this would be, in order to establish this as a primary land use on a piece of land, it would have to go to the Planning Commission for review. And in order for you to have some operational standards as to how you would regulate such a land use, we have proposed some operational standards for consideration. These include parcel size standards, setbacks, parking, lighting requirements, and then some references to overnight camping. So what that looks like in detail is that a special event facility would have to be a 10-acre minimum. Contiguous parcels may, however, combine to meet that requirement. There are setbacks, 50 feet setbacks from roads and parcel lines and easements. There would be parking requirements as established in the parking section, so we would require that these commercial facilities would be able to sustain parking and travel and customer base. And then set a maximum capacity of 1,000 persons. And then it also limited the overnight camping capabilities of these types of facilities. This is not a state mandated land use, one that we are seeing as though is best practice, something that we have seen requested and something that is proposed for consideration in the amendment.
Commissioner Hart.
How does this differ to wedding venues that we just
well, it would be for any new event moving forward.
So.
And so the.
What was wrong with what we did in Monterey Green that changed?
So because the standards that are identified in there, for example, you see the maximum capacity, how it's 1,000 people, which is clearly way more than we've discussed in any prior use permits. This will be integrated into the ER analysis of the general plan, right? So we're trying to beef up certain uses, events, activities to have them embedded into the EIR so they are exempted.
All right,
so we can rely on the EIR.
Does that mean that I'm going to take in the Blackberry Festival up at Ski Park that we did 10 years ago,
mm-hmm.
and then the new ones? Does that mean for those venues they are limited to what's there and they can't take advantage of this, or do they have to come back and reapply and do everything under these guidelines?
I would say they could do a use permit modification to increase based on the updated, you know, local, you know, regulations that we have in place. So that would be the process for that. If the process will be a use permit approved by Planning Commission, right?
I would add to Commissioner Hart, it's special event facility, so it's contemplating structures, that sort of thing. If you're having an event at the park type of thing, that wouldn't apply.
The
use permits that we have approved have a limiting factor.
Yes.
Whether it be parking, building square footage. Well,
it's occupancy.
Those two venues, they
don't. Well, the Allen one,
mm-hmm.
assigned parking in the use permit limited the number of attendees.
Right, but it can be expanded.
Yes.
Very easily.
Yes. No, I agree with that.
Yeah, and the main reason for those limiting factors was we were trying to stay within a reasonable CEQA exemption without having it be, you know, litigated. Yeah.
But we throw this number in here, do the EIR,
yes.
Now okay. They can come back.
Mm-hmm.
Since we're on the temporary short-term events, can someone explain to me how the number 14 in the duration, 14 consecutive days, was arrived at, and 4 short-term events in annual limitation? Where did those numbers come from? And is that saying that you could do 4 14-day straight events? Because to me, that is more impactful than having 14 single-day events. You see where I'm going? I think 4 events by right, etc., may be a little low, but at the same time, I think a 14 straight day event causes more impact than single days.
Was the 14 days relying on our camping
that number
to coincide with the overnight stays?
That number was selected, and it can be changed. That number was selected, though, to prevent certain uses that people will say, well, this is just temporary, but they do it all year long. So we selected 14 days to say, well, you can't have a year-long yard sale, you know? It's just a yard sale, you know? But if you have it all year long, it's not really, it's just a commercial lot in front of your house. And so we put that date, that time frame in there to allow enforcement. So it can be changed, but 14 days, I think a two week.
So they can run 1 day or 14, whatever fits their program.
Yes.
As long, correct. And then the four, we were thinking quarterly. So again, this was just supposed to be short term events that would be taking place at on a property. So limiting it to a quarterly events felt, at least as a starting point, a good starting point to work from.
And I also know this was a reaction to commission's prior comments in different meetings where well, why should we, they have to get a use permit to just have a wedding, you know, on the property? So we said, well, if you're only doing four a year, then it's not really a, it's not an ongoing thing, so that should be okay. You don't need a use permit, but if you're gonna be doing all year round, then we might wanna consider putting you under a use permit so we have some more formal guidelines, right? So that would either fall into under special event facility. Because prior conversations with the commission would say, well, I wanna have a wedding in the barn, you know? Why do I, you know, it's accessory to my main use of the property, but I'm not doing it as the main thing. I don't feel like I need a use permit. And so we felt, well, four times a year, that's not so impactful. But if you're converting it into a all year round operation, then it probably makes sense for you to come in here, show us the building plans, show us the operational model, so the planning commission could put guardrails on that. But again, you can change those numbers, but those were selected by staff just because it made the most sense, and by quarter that would make sense.
And we did. We do have in that section on page 131, temporary short-term events, 2E, private gatherings exempt. So we are exempting private gatherings that would be for like private weddings, that would be incidental. This and we're acknowledging that those would still be lawful uses of your residential lot. We're not looking to regulate those. It's more of those commercial activities where you have, where now it's becoming like an event venue, where now you're hosting more than four weddings. It's, okay, now this is becoming kind of, it's going beyond what was just reasonable from it, whatever number we set. But that should be what now is beyond reasonable for it being accessory. Mm-hmm.
So there's a venue in South County that has weddings as part of their business. County. And you'd have to go back and look at their original plan. But does this mean they're going to then have to come back in and go through the permit process to modify their use permit to run a resort and have wedding because they have something in this 15 year?
I would say
I guess what I want to know is how we're putting these new regs in. And people have already got things, are they going to be grandfathered in?
That's usually how it goes, right? If you already have an existing use permit, we don't say, okay, all you people need to come back in and reapply.
Well,
unless there's
permit.
An enforcement action.
Right. But our use permits will typically outline occupancy and events and all of that. So if they wanted to go and be compliant with new regs, it would be a use permit modification, I think.
Yeah, you're right. So the conditional
but
use
it would
permit,
be grandfathered. Like the use permit's allowable. It's not
well.
Going
the use
away.
Permit would stay. It would run with the land, so it stays as it is now. So let's say they were only permitted 10 events a year and 300 people. Mm-hmm. Even though the code's updated, they wouldn't be grandfathered in jumping to 1,000 because their use permit is at the 10 events 300. If they want to move to what the new regulations are, they'd have to come in to the planning department and do like a use permit modification to adapt to the new, and that can be done because the general plan and zoning would have already gone through the EIR process, which
right,
would have
and
analyzed.
Mm-hmm.
So expanded
right,
that.
Right, and we could, with confidence say, you know, there won't be a CEQA cost associated with that. You know, it's an administrative process and step, but, you know, it would just be the cost of a modification versus, you know, right now, if someone wanted to increase their occupancy, it could potentially be an M&D or something, right?
And there could be a financial benefit too, because the cost of the modification, I mean, the amount that they could increase the operation would outweigh the cost of a modification. So there could be a benefit potentially to that.
Mm-hmm.
So shooting from the hip on duration, 14 seems a bit excessive to me, straight days. I think 7 is more digestible. And at the same time on D, annual limitation, we really don't in Siskiyou County have a major concern about year-round thanks to our winter. But I wouldn't be opposed to upping that to at least six.
You're talking about six short-term events.
Yeah. This is on 131.
So limited to 7 days, six events.
Seven consecutive days? Because I don't know of many events that take place. I mean, even when we're having a horse workshop, a clinician comes in for working a cow horse at our place. The longest is maybe 4 days. Usually they're, it's a 2 day and a 2 day for different levels, and then they're done. But 14 days is a long time. Mm-hmm. I mean, that's like a state fair.
Yeah.
And part of, part of that's building in flexibility, but even 7 days is pretty flexible. Day,
wouldn't it kind of get stuff scheduled? Mm-hmm. Wouldn't it be better to have that flexibility in there so that you can fit your schedule in instead of going, okay, I need to do something for a week? How much lead time do you need to get everybody scheduled to fit into that?
Well, no. This limitation here is what you wouldn't need to use permit for. If you were wanted to go beyond 7 days or do more than six events, then you need to do use permit. But by right, you could do up to seven consecutive days or up to six events without having to get a use permit.
Well, you have to get an administrative use permit. But that's just approved by
the director.
I think that would be more digestible for me.
Yeah, I concur with the 7 days. I mean, 14 days, I'm just thinking of some of the events. That is a big impact.
Yeah. Oh, it's wild.
Yeah.
Were there any other questions on the temporary uses? I do have.
Does that include temporary construction yards? Because I have a question on that, on page 132. You haven't touched on it verbally, but it's part of the temporary.
So on-site construction yards, go into this section here, either require a zoning clearance permit associated with a valid active building permit for the site. And then the duration of that allowed by right would have to coincide with the duration of the building permit. And then it looks like an administrative use permit would be required if the construction site is located not on the construction site, so it would be located off-site. And then would have to not exceed 12 months tied to the specific construction process. So I think we capture those standards within this section. But you wouldn't have to get an administrative use permit if it was located on site.
Okay, so here's where my question is. With Pacific Power's subcontractors, we have in Scott Valley three, technically they're off-site construction yards because they're storing the steel poles, their lifts, everything. One's on Horn Lane, one's at Finley's, another one down there. Did the landowner have to come in to get an administrative permit? Did Pacific Power come in and get the permit? Did 1884 come in and get the permit as the lessee? Does U.S. Forest Service have to come in and get a permit for the fire camps? Or
yes.
Is that simply allowable where I'm right as long as it's not greater than a certain percent?
Our construction yard regulations now are really prohibitive. We don't have any approved permits for any off-site construction yards right now, but it can be either the property owner or the provider, as long as they have like property owner authorization.
So I'm not trying to open a can of worms
yeah.
here because I don't have a problem with what's happening.
Sure.
I think it makes sense.
Yeah.
Did a permit have to be pulled by 1884 to store their equipment on ag land? Or was it simply, hey, allowed knowing it's going to be for a year, year and a half, and then it's going to be gone?
It was not allowed. It's just kind of occurred. And this has come up with other construction projects because, again, like our current regulations are really prohibitive. It requires, you know, the formal use permit process even for temporary construction yards. So, you know, we actually try to recommend that folks just go to industrial zones or something within, like, the city jurisdiction. Like, I think there was one in the town of Fort Jones, or there is one in the town of Fort Jones, like, by their yard. So we try to find other available locations.
And if there's not, and if there are not, then they're occurring without a permit, and
yes.
the county's just saying, get the work done.
It's just kind of the county looks to be
okay.
the other way
okay.
for
okay.
the supervisor.
No, and I get that, but
yeah.
it's like, this isn't going to be a one and done. It's going to happen again in the future. And
yeah.
I think we need to be flexible enough.
Yes.
Whether it be in a Pacific Power utility type event, a Siskiyou telephone,
mm-hmm.
Cal Moore, go into a Forest Service or a Cal Fire fire camp that
yeah.
sprouts up every year mm-hmm. for weeks.
Yeah, I agree. And that's
why. It's temporary,
yeah.
but are we really going to be requiring Forest Service or the state of California or the Peckhams to have to come in and get a use permit to allow that camp to operate?
Right, and that's why we want to be flexible, and that's why we try to draft something to where there would be, you know, either allowable outright or at least an administrative permit so it's noted, so it can just kind of be a reoccurring thing when it's needed, because there's things pop up where you can't plan for it, especially with emergency situations, right? So.
And so, you just hit the nail on the head, which is where I was going.
Mm-hmm.
Is there an emergency exclusion?
There's one.
Does it allow for fire camps
yes.
and construction yards?
So the temporary construction yards, this section was specifically put in to deal with that situation where they would have had to get a use permit to do the temporary construction yards out in Scott Valley, but there was no time to get that done, so that we just kind of...
Okay.
that it occur, but with this being placed in there, then if they needed to do that, they just come in and say, hey, we're going to put in a temporary construction yard, and we can issue it that day.
Okay.
And that's on what, page 134.
Yes, on page 132, I think, temporary construction yards. And then
emergency facilities.
And then the emergency facilities, that's on 134.
Correct.
Sorry. Who carries the liability? The county?
No.
The property
it's on their property
is listed as additionally insured. At least that's how the three that I know of. That
I can name you a whole pile of them here in South County where it's been going on for decades. And,
but those aren't very temporary then.
No, they're not temporary. They're year-round.
Yeah, yeah.
One of them is an international company.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
They came to the county to get a use permit and a zone change, and it all just went away, and the operation is continuing.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. And to clarify, with Section 4 discussing the temporary construction yard uses, with and that's in conjunction with an approved construction project, right? Because these are things that are typically known about, you know, in advance. Hey, there's going to be some monies for a Caltrans project in the next 6 months or whatever, right? So then bidders and contractors will try to find locations near where the road is being improved, right? So it's kind of for that use, so they can just come in, quickly get an approved, you know, administrative permit, just so it's on record, and then go about their day, so they don't have to worry about public noticing, use permit processing, because that is obviously, you know, lengthy, and that's the problem we have now with those types of projects, right? Is that they're cumbersome for this. You just need to get in, get the approved permit, and go about your day, you know? So.
And then to follow up on the emergency facilities, the fire camps, if you need a fire camp, you don't need a use permit, you just set it up. That's how we wrote it. But it has to be a an actual emergency.
Declared emergency.
Right, it's got
to
be.
That's the key. So basically the supervisors would have to make a declaration.
Or the state, or, you know, the
right.
There must be some sort of official emergency that you can use to justify, hey, we need an emergency camp.
I mean, I, with the current makeup of people, I don't think it's ever going to be an issue.
Mm-hmm.
But I'm just looking out for the private landowners who graciously, even though they were well paid, said, hey, yeah, you can use my field for fire camp. And really, we haven't had too many official emergency declarations declared for fires. It's not something that really happens. And
yeah.
Okay, I'm thinking in the future.
Sure, yeah, totally.
I have a question on the timing of the declared emergency for restoration of those sites. So one thing just to point out, and this is under the temporary emergency facilities 8 and then C under restorations. It says a temporary structure and associated improvement shall be removed and the site restored within 30 days following the termination of the declared emergency. I just wanted to point out to the county, and I don't know if this is your intent, but some of the fires, there's a declared emergency for years.
Mm-hmm.
So just make sure you're
yeah.
aware that, like, it could be years before that site is restored, even knowing the fire camp left.
Yep.
Okay.
Before we leave this section, I do have one brief mention about the vacation rentals. Right now, we have a hard set acreage where if it's less than 2.5 in South County, you can't have a vacation rental
yeah.
permit. We've changed that to say, if it's less than 2.5, rather than a hard no, that application will come before the Planning Commission. That was the way we balanced it, where it would give the Planning Commission an opportunity to look at that specific property to see if it made sense to restrict it just because it was 2.5 acres.
I concur. I know Tony Mello will
yeah.
be happy about that.
That was the thing we argued.
Did you have something to say?
Yeah, before we move on, because I'm looking at the special event facility, and what hit me and I noticed is reading under A on 134, it specifically identifies agricultural operations. I think I know the intent of putting this in, but I kind of feel, so I built an arena
mm-hmm.
and a round pen at my place for my own use. We use it to work cattle. Yeah, we have clinicians that come from around the country that come in for 2 or 3 days
working
ranch horse, cow horse clinics.
Mm-hmm.
It is not a special event facility. It's a ranch. They're using my arena. Is there a reason why ag operations, those two words, were put into A under special event facility? Because when I see this, I think more a facility is specifically being built for events, not an existing farm or ranch that accessory to the farm and ranch operation events are taking place. You see the difference? I did not build that arena with the intent to have special events.
Right.
It's a working, functioning part of the ranch. It's used accessory-wise.
Mm-hmm.
Why is ag operations listed?
It's similar to, it's trying to put, like, it's language to try to ensure protection of surrounding agricultural operations. So you have an agricultural operation, a special event facility moves in and goes, oh, we have outdoor weddings, but I don't like the fact that my neighbor does ag and they're tilling their property because that is affecting our wedding. So this is mainly just saying, if you're going to move into an area, just realize what's around you. So just to be cognizant of that it's compatible with the rural nature of the county, that there's ag operations, there's other things around you. Because the majority of those special event facilities in a county such as Siskiyou are going to be outside in unincorporated areas.
Okay, so it's more a protection. As a recognition that you had other activities taking place around where a special facility may be built.
Correct. When I was a planner, just a little experience, when I was a planner for Madera County, we had similar language put in when wedding event venues went out into the rural areas, because you're surrounded by vineyards, dairies, other ag operations that were there before you. And it's not that that moves in and they cease to operate.
Okay, I was reading it differently. Mm-hmm. Now that you say that, that makes sense.
I would add to that, Commissioner Powell. I think you're talking about number 6, is that right? Agricultural building?
No, it's a 10-100.
I was looking at 10-100-110, the language used in A.
Okay.
But now that it's been explained, I get why that's there. Okay, I withdraw my concern there. That makes sense.
Okay. Any other comments from commissioners? Okay, are we moving on to part 5?
Sorry, no.
No.
We have some more.
Okay.
So these next couple are going to be specific to some state law requirements and your housing element. And ensuring that we're remaining consistent and compliant with your approved housing element is essential. The state recently so graciously updated their ADU regulations again. So in March, they released a new guidebook and have provided some further clarifications that we have built into your ADU regulations. So just so you're aware what some of those state mandated guidelines are, is they essentially allow ADUs by right in your single family and in your multifamily zones. So zones that allow single family homes and multifamily apartments or multifamily units are allowed to have ADUs. From a single family perspective, which is I feel is the most use case for ADUs, the state has clarified that a single family home can have actually up to 3 accessory dwelling units. You can have up to 1 attached unit, so it should be a new unit that you are attaching to your home. You can then construct another detached unit, so that is a unit that is not attached to your existing dwelling. And then you can also have, if you meet all those requirements, you can also have what's called a junior ADU. And imagine that being a unit that is constructed entirely within your home. You carve out a portion of your home dedicated to an entire independent living unit.
Would that be like a garage conversion or no?
This would be different. This would be like if you were to separate off a master bedroom and add a kitchenette into it.
And
okay.
I'm sure your
30-year-old
kid doesn't leave.
Yes,
I'm sure they don't.
Yes, I'm sure.
Don't
worry.
Yeah. Going out.
So these are, again, these are state-mandated allowances. With that, the state is also gracious to provide us a series of standards that we have to comply with, development and operational standards that they make so they provide guidance on in this guidebook. That we have since used and implemented to update your regulations. Say there's not really any leeway here. State requires that we incorporate this allowance into your housing element. We also factor it into your general plan, and we also codify it in your zoning regulations. So at a base minimum, we have updated all of your standards, all of the development standards for compliance with this recently updated regulation. I would just say for future, just so you're aware, these are going to change again. It'll probably change the year after that. So just be aware this is something that is constantly evolving and the state's providing guidance.
Okay. On the single family home with up to 3 ADUs, mm-hmm. is there square footage minimums for parcel size?
Yes.
That can happen? Okay. And then... I'm thinking sewer, septic.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, those would still apply.
Okay,
yeah.
So those also apply.
You still have to have sufficient land to accommodate that.
So okay. You still have to
So it's not a by right for the 3, but But it's a by right that you can do something, just maybe not.
As long as you're complying with all of the health, sanitation, other county standards, they would be allowed by right. You have to comply with everything, though. And in some cases, a lot of this wouldn't be potentially feasible. I think there's a huge cost associated with these two. These aren't necessarily the cheapest things to construct on your property to get through by right. I think that was the state's intent, but it's extremely costly to develop in California. I haven't seen a use case where I've seen the maximum of these ever really used, but potentially you could maximize your lot and have up to three additional units.
And the one thing I do want to point out is that previously, in previous drafts that the state put out, it was two ADUs. The three is new, so now it's up to three. And they did loosen up the setback restrictions, the separation requirements, restrictions between units. This won't really affect Siskiyou County as much, but more urban areas, you can have ADUs in your front yard now. So there's a lot of kind of ways that they've kind of opened it up, cut the tape, and said, well, let's just see what happens. But as Michael mentioned, having worked with the AD law since it came out, we haven't really seen a lot of this catch fire take. I mean, there's just the cost to build a standalone ADU is expensive. I would say the one piece of leeway is that there are some communities that look at utilities from like whether there's capacity perspective, but it's really, really iffy, and HCD does watch it. So when you do adopt an AD ordinance, HCD gets a copy of it and then checks it to make sure, and they'll follow up on compliance. So that's just something to be aware of.
Okay. Yeah, and I just, you know, thinking out loud with, you know, fire density with these additional structures, I'm sure there's complexities there.
Yeah, I mean, we're currently working with communities in high wildfire hazard areas, and it's the answer is, well, kind of one size fits all, a too bad approach.
Well, you sure see what California is trying to do. They're trying to increase housing without going through a subdivision law. This is how they do it. Mm-hmm. Right?
Mm-hmm. Which, you know, just thinking out loud on timberland, every one of those buildings would need a timberland conversion permit. And if you've already used yours to build your primary home, now you're in full-blown CEQA to do your additional